As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This podcast is brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at DirecTV.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Big Football Show, a podcast by The Athletic about Big Ten football. Today is Tuesday, October 19th, and this is Scott Docterman, and I write about the Big Ten and the University of Iowa. Today, I'm joined by Big Ten Network analyst Anthony Herron, and we discuss the league as a whole that includes the best and deepest position and, I should say, division in college football. Anthony, welcome to the Big Football Show. How are you today?
Doing great, Scott. Really appreciate you inviting me on the show. Always an honor to talk to you, sir, and especially get the opportunity to break down the Big Ten.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you. And some we're on kind of both ends. Sometimes I'm on Sirius with you, and sometimes you're on phone calls with me. But this is the first time on Zoom for The Athletic. So you've got a pretty good gig, I think, with BTN. You're going out to campuses on Saturday mornings. I see you trying all these different foods. I think what was last week was Madison with these rolls and stuff. And I'm like, man, there can't be a better job in college sports than what you do at.
No doubt, Scott. I've been pretty blessed, man, to the years I spent flying out west every weekend covering the Pac-12 conference for a lot of fun. But there's no doubt this feels more like home, being back with the Big Ten Network, doing studio shows during the week with Dave Revson and Mike Hall. Then on the weekends, I've been able to travel and call a number of games, as you know. But yeah, last couple of weeks, it's been a good time heading out to the campuses, doing the Big Ten Network's pregame tailgate show. And still got like Dave and the guys, Jerry, Howard, Joshua there in studio. I've been able to join Annie Sable and Brock Vereen out on the road for a couple of weeks. So we've been at least the spots I've been to get to go to Madison this past weekend, taste some food. It was a lot of fun. And on the air, we had something called a Kringle, which that I think that was what you saw us kind of chowing down on. I'd never had a Kringle before. What I'm a little bit disappointed by is that we didn't get any encased meats. Like I was hoping to get like a bratwurst or, something like that on the air. We didn't get any of that. But before I left town, I did make sure I got some cheese curds.
Okay. I tell you what, I went to Dottie's once in downtown Madison over by the Kohl Center. And I was covering a basketball game with the Badgers and Hawkeyes, gosh, probably 7-8 years ago now. And it was during a Packers playoff game, and went in there, it was packed, as you can imagine. Then got a big cheese curds, got a big burger. It was about 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon. I couldn't eat till 1 the next day. It was just incredible. I sat there on press row and I couldn't even move. I was like, man, I can't get up.
So, right. Seems like the type of food you want to make sure you're going to take a nap afterwards. If you're really going to go head first in the food in Madison, you don't want to necessarily be driving too far afterwards.
Exactly. So if you get a State Street brat, you get some cheese curds and whatever beer they're serving, which is there's a lot of good ones there in the state of Wisconsin, you're in good shape. But how is it working alongside Brock Vereen? You got a Gopher and a Hawkeye side by side.
Yeah, It's been a good time. One thing, we were kind of having a good time with the other day because we were outside Camp Randall. And so each of us have our own separate sort of instances of personal memories that we had in playing at Wisconsin. That's the cool thing, man, where you're a former Big Ten athlete and you get the opportunity to travel around to these different campuses. And, you know, I'm older than Brock, so we don't know each other well. And so we've got the opportunity to get to know each other for a few weeks here. It's fun just to kind of share stories and cover the conference. And the other day he was talking about, you know, what it's like playing for Paul Bunyan's Axe. I was talking about what it's like just being there at Camp Randall, and of course, jump around and House of Pain, that all has to come up. And, you know, the weather, it was the first site we were at being in Madison where the weather became a little bit of an issue. It was a little chilly as the show started. And you obviously know how it is in Big Ten country. I don't anticipate that changing. All the difference is I'm, of course, much bigger than Brock. I'm from the Midwest originally, where he's a DB from California. So I think the cold weather affects him in a little different way.
Sure. And did he play outside, or was he still in the dome? I can't remember. I think he was probably outside by then when he was playing. But
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
But you were in the dome, so.
Yep, Metrodome. It was a different deal back then, and they had all the fake crowd noise and everything else going. I was like, come on. There's more Hawkeye fans in the stands right now than there are Gopher fans. There's no way on third down that Minnesota fans can be making this much noise. We know what you guys are doing. Come on, stop messing around.
You know what they did during the World Series. We cut in with Kirby Puckett, you know, the wind going in and out, you know, turning on the fans. So, yeah, they did whatever they could for a home field advantage. It was pretty fun. But I tell you what, looking at this league right now with five teams still in the top 11, the Big Ten East is unquestioned, in my eyes, the best division in college football with four teams in the top nine. And kind of what's your observations of the league as a whole? Did anything surprise you, or did you feel like this was a possibility all along?
I thought there was a good opportunity for Mel Tucker in his second year in East Lansing to show some progress. I didn't see this. And I got to call their game in week two when they faced Youngstown State. It was a week before they traveled down to South Beach and took down Miami. But even at that point, you know, just very early in the season, I was already getting a sense after getting to watch them in person, the efficiency that Peyton Thorne played the game with, and just how much more athletic the Spartans are. And, you know, part of that certainly, and obviously part of the discussion that's been had is about the transfer portal and Mel Tucker bringing in talent from other places. Obviously, Kenneth Walker III is chief amongst those in the Heisman discussion. But even defensively, they're a faster defense than they were last year as well, and a more active defense also. So I love what they're doing, really, in just sort of reshaping the roster in quick fashion. Long term, it may not be the way to kind of build consistency, but, you know, in year two, it's really impressive to see what Mel Tucker is doing there. And I think, you know, surprising on the opposite end would be Nebraska, because, you know, in Scott Frost's second season, where everybody thought, oh, they finished hot in year one and they had some close games. And then remember that second year when he was at UCF and how great they were then. And I tried to caution everyone back then, he doesn't necessarily have a roster together yet. So Huskers fans, just pump your brakes a little bit, give him some time. And they didn't. They got all worked up. And then, of course, the last couple of seasons have still been a struggle. But I did think this year, with a senior in Adrian Martinez, all the football he's played, what he began to show last year after being benched briefly for McCaffrey and then coming back into the lineup, he started to look like the Adrian Martinez we had seen previously. He's pretty much looked like that most of the season this year, aside from their week zero game against the Illini. Now, he's played at a really high level, but he has. Him and a number of his teammates have been a part of some of those crucial errors that we see late in game. Some of it on the players, whether it's interception or fumbles. Some of it certainly on the coaches, you know, schematic blunders that seem to happen, you know, some undisciplined penalties that take place. And all these close games the Huskers continue to lose, it still shows progress, while at the same time, it's hard not to look at it and through my lens, be surprised that we haven't seen Nebraska yet come up with what we would consider kind of a big upset, a major win. They played tough against some quality teams. There's a lot of ball left. So I think Nebraska is going to sort of have their moment before the season's over, but I'm surprised it hasn't really come yet.
I agree. I mean, you look at their schedule, it's as difficult as any in college football. They're, you know, one of their non-conference games is at Oklahoma, you know, historic rival. I mean, Michigan and Michigan State, nobody would have saw them rising up after last year, and they played well. And, you know, and then but then they seem to have these letdown moments. You have they had a breakout day against Northwestern, 56-7. They look like, okay, they're the second best team in the West, and they've got a chance to really take that jump. And then they just find ways to lose, you know, whether it was against Michigan with a late fumble or the punt against Michigan State, you know, last week you go to, because they dominated the second half of Michigan State, and then Minnesota last week, just not being able to, punch through
really had some goal to go scenarios. That the kicking game has been such a struggle for them, and you know, you feel for Connor Culp and some of the struggles that have been there, but it hasn't just been him and missing kicks. You referenced Michigan State. The return game has been really difficult for Nebraska at times, with blunders that have been made there, but then also the coverage game where opponents have had big returns like Michigan State. So it's kind of every phase of special teams has let them down at different points, and that's where, you know, if it's just one phase of the game, one particular position group, that's one thing. But when kind of all the special teams have led to defeats, that's where, as a coaching staff, and this has been a discussion for Nebraska for years now, where Scott Frost and his staff need to find a way to hone in on that. They don't have a specific special teams coordinator, quote unquote. They did bring in a specialist over the offseason, you know, to sort of analyze things for them on special teams and try to help tighten screws there a little bit. It hasn't paid dividends yet. Even last week's game against the Gophers, you know, Culp drills a 50-yard field goal early in the game. Like, all right, that's got to be a confidence boost, and maybe they'll get going from there. And it still didn't, you know, kind of lead to additional returns. And maybe that factors into why you see them going for a fourth and goal when you think maybe it makes more sense to take the points. You got running backs tripping when the end zone seems to be available to them. So that's a really surprising one for me as far as Nebraska goes. I will say, I think from my perspective after Big Ten Media Days with Michigan was different than maybe a lot of other folks coming into this season, but I think even specifically different than mine had been in recent years with the Wolverines, because I feel like usually when I see Michigan players at Big Ten Media Days, I could see and I could feel the weight of expectation on them, kind of a rigidness, a rigidity to just their demeanor. I didn't necessarily see that with Josh Ross and Aiden Hutchinson and Hassan Haskins in Indianapolis this year. I saw guys who seemed comfortable in their own skin, comfortable with the not only the expectations of Michigan football, but you know, they seemed fairly confident in their ability to achieve amidst the expectations of being a Michigan man and bringing the Wolverines back to prominence. Now, you know, we've seen Michigan under Jim Harbaugh start whatever they're at, 6-0, and be in the top 10. We've seen these stretches before, so the jury is still out as far as whether or not Michigan will achieve at the level that maybe Michigan fans think they should, winning a division, taking down the Buckeyes, some of those things. But I did think, you know, because the talent will always be there, and I did think after seeing their players in person, I was talking about it a lot on Big Ten radio, that they did seem more relaxed, more comfortable in their own skin. And conversely, I kind of thought it was the Nebraska players that looked like maybe they had more tension built up and were sort of wearing the expectations of their program. And I felt like Michigan, for whatever reason, has been able to sort of, you know, find a way through that. And I think that more relaxed temperament, let's say, I mean, it still obviously work the tails off and play hard, but as far as just wearing the expectations, they seem more comfortable in that when I saw them in Indy.
Yeah, and I thought what was interesting with Michigan was last year, the way that they ended that season, they were probably lucky that COVID or whatever issues they ended up having, they didn't play Ohio State or Iowa. And I don't mean this hyperbolically, but they would have lost by probably 60 points to Ohio State and at least 40 to Iowa. I mean, both teams would have just smashed them. And at that point, if you're losing by a combined 100 points, again, I don't think I'm too far-fetched based on what we saw against Wisconsin, that at that point, do they say, okay, we can't have Jim Harbaugh back, we got to have another coach. Mm-hmm. And then you move into a different direction and things are different. And I think in some ways, even though their schedule has been conducive and teams like Washington haven't been very well than they expect, but still, you know, they've got a lot of positive vibes. They've ran the ball really well. They look more like a Michigan team. And we'll know in the coming weeks, starting next week for sure, you know, when they play the Spartans, whether or not they are, a legit title contender or just merely a pretty good team. But I think they made a really good turnaround, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think I wonder where the expectations of the fan base truly are right now. I feel like people are still a little pensive, you know, kind of, you know, the optimism that it feels like it's building, but not necessarily folks kind of pumping their chest. Like you think back to a few years ago, the whole revenge tour thing that was going on, like, yeah, we're going to take on the world and we can play the villains and this and that. And, you know, you don't necessarily see them pounding their chest to that extent. And I'm not even against it when it comes down to it. I was on board with it, you know, a couple of years ago, the revenge tour thing. I'm like, hey man, if you're that confident and you feel good and you're playing that well, then pump your chest, enjoy this. Like I'm not one of these who's, while it wasn't necessarily my way, you know, if I make a play, I pretty much high five somebody and go back to the huddle, but I love it. I dig it. I eat it up when someone else is willing to expend the extra energy to do that or go to the media and speak in this uber confident manner, because I find it entertaining. I find it invigorating to see folks willing to, you know, to sort of enjoy the moment like that. There's obviously a balance to it and a line to it. But from this year's crop of Wolverines, Aiden Hutchinson he's kind of a live wire as a personality, but he's not necessarily saying anything incendiary. He's not giving bulletin board material to the opponents out there. Same with Josh Ross and some of the other Michigan defenders. And, you know, of course, a quarterback, Cade McNamara, I think he's doing an effective job for them. But I felt like the coaching staff early in the season, they kind of reined in the passing attack, especially once that Ronnie Bell injury happened. Like, all right, it's about the rushing attack. You were talking about how well they've run the football in most games. They've had a dominant run game. And then just sort of in recent weeks, game by game, we've seen them expand the passing attack a little bit more. And I talked about that a bit after the Rutgers game, where I was saying, I think Michigan's going to have to learn to trust Cade McNamara a bit more to throw on first down, to attack downfield, where it seems like they've still got some talented receiver in Ike. He doesn't have as live an arm as J.J. McCarthy, the true freshman five-star backup, but he's got enough arm talent to be able to get it down there. And we've seen them start to do that in recent weeks. I'm very curious, coming off of their bye, what the Michigan offense will look like, what they'll be willing to show, and then how that'll build towards, you know, essentially you referenced next weekend. Like once we hit October 30th, that East division is going to be battle after battle, conflict zone after conflict zone, over and over again, just on a weekly basis. We're going to see teams getting it on, taking each other on, who are right now not only in the Big Ten championship picture, but you got squads with national championship implications as these games come up.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Let's look at the other matchup in that East when that happens. Penn State, you know, had a week off after, what is it, fall down gate or whatever you want to call it. it was a pretty crazy off week there, but between for both schools. But
right.
But Penn State coming to Iowa and losing by three with a backup quarterback for most of the game. I don't think they acquitted themselves poorly at all in that matchup. And in fact, you know, it's debatable. They still got the yell, so they still have to carry that. But when Sean Clifford was in there, they looked like the better team at that point. And then you've also got Ohio State, which is the flagship enterprise of the Big Ten, and four straight titles, and still I think they're the highest ranked of the teams. In fact, I know they are.
Yeah.
So it's in some ways for the national title situation, it's almost an elimination game because they both have a loss. If you get two, that's going to be hard to get into that top four. How do you see – what are the strengths and maybe even weaknesses of those teams, and how do you see that game playing out?
I think, you know, if we're just kind of assuming that Penn State will take down the Illini this week, that Ohio State would take down, who is it, Indiana, I think the Buckeyes have this week. Right. Spinning it forward towards next week then, if they're both still in the top 10 and looking strong there. I think, of course, a lot of that from Penn State's perspective will depend on if it's Taquan Roberson or if it's going to be Sean Clifford at quarterback. And it's just hard to say. You know, unsurprisingly, it's been, been fairly mysterious up to this point. What struck me in Penn State's reaction to things after the Sean Clifford injury, it wasn't all on Roberson. Now, obviously, you're on the road. It's a hostile environment. I mean, you know, as you know well, can be as hostile as any environment in college football. It can be as intimidating as any atmosphere that anyone can be in, either pro or college. And so you get a backup quarterback thrust into that, and he didn't necessarily have his teammates picking him up. Like, even Jahan Dotson, one of the most, you know, explosive talents in the country. He's throwing downfield to him. Looks like there's some opportunities. Maybe Dotson should start to play DB instead of just being a receiver. You know, interceptions and pass deflections happening where he's not necessarily picking up his QB. You got the offensive line who's flinching, and not just flinching because they're not going silent snap, but even just Iowa, as the Hawkeyes' defensive front was stemming late in the snap, just moving, trading from one gap to the other pre-snap. You got offensive linemen flinching left and right. And then you get to Roberson just looking uncomfortable and uneasy, especially in situations where he was backed up. So everything fell apart when Sean Clifford left the lineup. And Penn State hasn't had really a legitimate or consistent tailback run game the entire year. So I think over their bye week, that's part of what they need to figure out. If he's going to continue at quarterback, how do they find ways to sort of manufacture a run game? Because, you know, Sean Clifford is a more than capable runner as a QB, but he got to the point as a passer in Mike Yurcich's offense where they didn't necessarily need him to run for 100 yards like he had done previously against the Hoosiers. So he could still extend plays. He can move the sticks, pick up some first downs here and there, but he wasn't a guy who was necessarily going to take off and try to run for touchdowns as he had when he was a younger player. Maybe they go back to that mold with Roberson if he is going to have to be the quarterback for some extended period of time here and utilize his mobility, because it was apparent. It was on display. He was inaccurate as a passer, but his mobility can potentially be something that supplements their run game in a way where not only does he gain yards for his team, but maybe opens up some running lanes for those tailbacks from Penn State. So I think that's got to be a part of their equation there. Now, you obviously make him susceptible to more hits, and, you know, you test his durability a bit if you go that route. And I think playing things close to the vest when you have a defense that's been as capable of shutting opponents down as Penn State's defense has shown itself to be this season, then that to me is at least what makes sense. Because I don't necessarily think you can go into this stretch run of games as Penn State and say that, well, we're going to be, you know, super conservative and just hope we can get a low scoring game into the fourth quarter. I think you got to find a way to put some points on the board. And if that means you are using your quarterback as a runner, perhaps putting him at risk at times, even though you're obviously right now not super confident in the backup who now may be your starter at Roberson. I don't even know who backs Roberson up if Clifford isn't healthy. So, you know, I do think it's going to be worth the risk, though, because you're trying to go and win a championship. You're not just playing this thing game by game. Big picture-wise, Penn State has got to make sure they're doing enough to put points on the board. So I do think that using the mobility of Roberson will have to be a part of their offense, even though right now you can look at it and say, you know, maybe their depth is so sapped at quarterback that it would put him at additional risk.
Yeah, I think so. Based on what I saw at Iowa City, and as you mentioned, I was on the field late in the game, and it was just deafening. And that new north end zone just keeps the sound in. That's where he was backed up when you have a punter in Iowa's case that, you know, knocks in six inside the 12, and you've got a young quarterback against a team that, you know, ball hawking secondary. That was a really tough ask for him. And I think in some ways, you know, you look at what they've got when they do go to, they're got to go to Columbus, and intimidating environments. You walk in that place, we've kind of always called it the Death Star. Because right. Just you walk in, you're like, okay, you're challenging the evil empire here. If you're defending, you know, and so I think they're going to have to do whatever makes him successful. And if there is something that I do kind of, I don't blame is the right word, but, you know, look at the Penn State staff and say they had an opportunity at halftime. It was 17-10 of that game in Iowa City to reevaluate their personnel because they weren't going to get Clifford in there. And yet they really didn't change a whole lot. They didn't seem that way. You know, whether it was just get him some success. He ran the ball a little bit and he did a nice job of it. And I think that's probably what you need to do and just to balance it, because when they go to Ohio State next week, you know what you're going to get is very, very explosive offense that you're not going to be able to contain this team for, you know, 10, 12, 14, 20, even 20 points. You're going to have to match some scores with them. And with that, and so they're going to have to provide something different, I think, than what they did the other day. Now, if Clifford's there, then they can run their whole offense. He's been nice, but, you know, and against Ohio State, where they're still working through some issues on defense. I think they're okay, but I don't say that they're what they were, you know, a couple of years ago when they had the Bosas or Chase Young or whatever. But Ohio State still, I think right now, based on what we've seen so far, to me, they're still, you've got to knock out the champ. And yeah. And I don't know if anybody can, just because I don't know if anybody can keep pace with that offense.
That's the thing. It's a really – I don't want to call it a difficult balance. It's certainly a balance, though, that Ryan Day has to walk, because when – and Michigan State deals with that a little bit right now, as explosive as their offense has been this season, passing and running with big chunk plays and quick scores, and for Ryan Day – he wants to put those quick points on the board. What he recognized a few weeks back after that Oregon defeat, and even after kind of a sleepy performance against Tulsa, was that they need more balance. We haven't heard Ryan Day use the word balance very much. And even when he uses it, he hasn't seemed committed to it in his previous seasons at Ohio State, but he hadn't had to be. They can run up the score on anyone in the country, and it hadn't been an issue until they make the college football playoff. But here during the regular season, it was the first time we saw Ryan Day and Ohio State tested to that extent. You come off a regular season defeat where you certainly weren't dominant against Minnesota in the opening game. And I think by the end of the year, we're going to recognize Minnesota's a pretty good team, as we're starting to see with them getting healthier everywhere but running back. But if you can keep losing talented running backs and do what Minnesota's doing, then we're going to see by the end of the year, they're a pretty good squad. They challenged Ohio State in the opener. Then the Buckeyes dropped the game against Oregon. Then they find themselves in a position where they just can't defend anyone. And it was Ryan Day's first, to me, his biggest test up to this point as a head coach. I talked about it on the Big Ten Network where, you know, he was in a bit of a cauldron right there where folks are challenging him and his authority. What's he doing with the program? He got players leaving in the midst of the season. He's demoting Kerry Combs. He's not calling the plays anymore. Not Matt Barnes is. There was a lot swirling around that Buckeye program. This is great to have all the 4- and 5-star talent that's there, but when you're deploying it and it's not going well, you got a lot to answer to. And I think has answered things really well. But that quick strike explosive offense, he still has needed to find a way to see how he bolsters up that Buckeye defense, and them running the ball has made a big difference. And the thing is, you can have big rushing attacks and big passing yardage in games and throw plenty of passing touchdowns and get everybody their stats without having to throw it 70 or 80% of the time. So I've enjoyed watching him balance the offense and seeing the approach adjusted on defense, a little more zone coverage, a few more eyes in the backfield as opposed to everyone chasing guys around in man. And it's made their lives on defense a little easier because they've sort of dialed back a bit of the aggression.
Yeah, you know, complimentary football is something that they haven't had to worry too much about. Right. Now they do. And, you know, last year they decided to go heavy with the run when they had Trey Sermon in the play.
It was once they made the same realization. They got really beat up front. They couldn't protect Justin Fields very well against Indiana or Northwestern. And even the Michigan State game where they got beat up on the offensive line, he finally recognized, oh, this pass-heavy approach isn't getting it. And that's where we finally saw Trey Sermon emerge and have record-breaking performances. Then when Sermon left the lineup in the college football playoff, then they looked like a very different squad. So that balance is something Ryan Day never really fully seems committed to. But I think I'm hoping for Buckeyes' perspective that he finally recognizes how important it is.
It's a tug of war. Yeah, you know, I mean, you could score. I mean, there's nothing wrong with scoring points, but if the opponent goes 65 yards, scores a touchdown, kicks off, you scored three plays later, and then you're putting your defense right back out on the field, at some point that quick passing game is going to come back to bite you. And one potential matchup where that could be a challenge for them is if they get to December and they play Iowa, your alma mater. when you have a secondary that is capable of disrupting the passing game the way they did, like they did against Maryland. I mean, that was the extreme case, but you know, they've had four interception day against Penn State, you know, three or four interceptions against Iowa State, some pretty good teams there, that if they can disrupt and intercept and show some coverage, then, you know, that could be an issue for Ohio State.
And then, I think that, go ahead.
But then on the other side for Iowa is the offense, which we kind of waited. I know I have. I've waited all year long. Okay, well, they struggled against Indiana and Iowa State, but they didn't need it. They had a big lead, milk the clock, get the win, move on. Now I'm kind of like, okay, we're seven games in. You know, they you can't be 125th in TFLs. You can't average 3.1 yards per carry. You get off the bus running. You got to do some stuff. Is there a way to salvage that part of the game for Iowa, and how do they do it in order to give themselves a real chance, not only to win the West, but to win in Indianapolis?
Well, I think, you know, for a lot of other programs, I would look at it and say, well, you know, you just don't have the personnel. And it's really hard to improve during the season. So probably lights out on that. Like, I think that, you know, Purdue is a team where, as much as I tend to just continue to hammer away at the notion of balance, you know, run to pass and how much that supports your offense and your defense, I don't think you do it at a fault. Like, I hammered Michigan early in the season because I thought, Michigan, it's great, you're dominating on the ground, but you're capable of throwing the ball effectively as well. So you should begin doing that. And they have, and I think it suits them. Purdue, conversely, and, you know, same thing with Ohio State. They can run it, they can throw it, they can do whatever they want offensively as well as anyone. Purdue, I think, is in a unique situation where they throw it really effectively, as Iowa fans have seen for years now. They don't run it well. They never have under Jeff Brohm, and whether it's new personnel or new schemes or whatever, we'll see. But as of right now, I don't have an issue when Purdue abandons the rushing attack because you got to move the ball. My issue is if you're capable of doing the other element as well and you don't, then that's a problem. So for Iowa, they're inconsistent in throwing the ball, that they scheme up some open receivers in key moments, and it's worked really well for them, but that's not a recipe for a championship season. That's a recipe to win, you know, key games here and there. You're not going to be a championship team if it's just, all right, we got to play it close to the vest and scheme up a shot play here and there and sort of hope for the best if our defense gets us the ball a bunch of times. You know, this is, and I've been saying this for a few weeks now, as much as I've reveled in the success of Hawkeye football throughout the season here, certainly not Kirk Ferentz's best offensive line. It's not his deepest receiver core. You know, I love Tyler Goodson as a running back. He's not Kirk's, you know, best running back that Kirk has ever had. But we are seeing a season that could shape up as one of the great team seasons that Iowa's had if they can kind of keep that complementary football approach that you referenced, if they can keep that going, where I think a lot of that ends up coming in is not only if you keep generating takeaways on defense, and I love what Phil Parker has done because he has had to find moments to mix in some man coverage with their zone. He certainly enhanced the blitz package because we haven't necessarily seen a pass rush that consistently gets home without that additional pressure. I think when it comes down to it offensively, we need to see if Spencer Petras gets to a stretch like he did towards the end of the year last year, where he's just more consistently accurate. He's kind of erratic in and out of games, especially early in games where, you know, even if it's a clean pocket, he'll sail the ball over a receiver's head. If he's on the bootleg, he might throw one in the dirt when he's trying to hit a tight end out in the flat. He's got to make all the easy throws. And then it's okay to be spotty on some of the more difficult passes because he's got the ability to make the big time throws and hit the difficult passes as well. But he's got to be far more consistent with the layups. And then from there, if you're a little up and down and inconsistent on the deep outs, like the Kent State game I called on the Big Ten Network earlier in the season, I went into some description about they're trying these deep outs. He's not necessarily throwing them in rhythm. Here's one that he's inconsistent where he misses. He throws one in the dirt or he sails one out of bounds. And then here's one where he's throwing it with better timing and getting it there as the receiver's coming out of his break. He's got the arm to do those things, but you don't have to do that in college to have success. But in Iowa's offense, he's got to make all the layups. He's got to be great throwing in stride in the flat. He's got to be great on the open curl routes. He's got to hit all the easy throws. Then it's okay to be inconsistent on the deeper ones. For the offensive line, you know how Kirk Ferentz operates. He's going to continue to hammer away at technique, at fundamentals. They're going to spend a lot of time on footwork, hand placement, pad level throughout this bye week, making sure that they're continuing to refine their approach up front. And I think the balance of Tyler Goodson and Ivory Kelly Martin and what they're doing and getting them the ball both between the tackles and out in space. I love some of the adjustments that Brian Ferentz has made to still get the football to his playmakers while not always necessarily saying it's got to be running it up into the teeth of the defense or between the tackles, because they haven't shown the capability to consistently do that. But I do think Iowa's the type of team. Like I say, David Shaw and Stanford out west, he's one of the other programs of just Kyle Whittingham in Utah, just consistently throughout the season, they're always a better team at the end of the year than they are at the start. It's one of the concerns that, you know, a lot of Hawk fans had about the start of Iowa's schedule this year, because it was going to require them playing at a high level early. And that's not always what the case has been. They've been able to withstand it for the most part coming into the bye. Now we'll see if you really get kind of a Hawkeye explosion coming out of this, and where the offense, as it did last year, can look more efficient and more consistent than it has earlier.
Yeah, I agree. I think in some ways, I look at the passing game and I think it can be sharper. I don't know that it can be go night and day more explosive. It's just a matter of kind of fundamentals improving, being more consistent. They're at 58% completion percentage, which isn't good, but I think they can get over 60, get to about 62, and I think they're about at the top of where they can be. The running game is the problem, and I think everything stems from that. Last year, they averaged 4.6 yards per carry, which in that style of offense is a winning number, is a championship kind of number. Mm-hmm. This year, 3.1, and it's just – I think Goodson's a really good back, and I think Kelly Martin is. And if they can get up in the decent number, then I don't think they'll have any problems in the West. But if they don't, if they get bogged down, then they leave their defense out there. And you mentioned Minnesota. Minnesota runs the ball well. If they can control the line of scrimmage – heck, they haven't beaten Iowa in Kinnick since you were a player. And I don't think that was slight, but that just shows you how long ago it was. And, you know, that's the type of team that can do something against them. Or, you know, going to Madison, which I think will be the lowest scoring game in the Big Ten this year. But do you see any of those teams in the West that are able to kind of overtake the Hawkeyes and get to Indianapolis? Or is this still Iowa's division to win?
I think it's Iowa's division to win while there are a number of threats that remain on the schedule. I mean, you know, we didn't even mention Nebraska as a part of that discussion yet, but everyone that can really play defense is going to give Iowa trouble until they prove otherwise. Now, you know, facing a team like Nebraska that can play defense but turns it over at a high clip, then, all right, that's going to be a problem for the Cornhuskers unless they learn to protect the football, which they haven't shown they can up to this point. But I think because you've got an excellent defense in Nebraska and a great defense with Minnesota and Purdue, Wisconsin has been one of the top defenses in America for years now. I mean, even Northwestern, that was against Rutgers, but Northwestern's acting like out of their bye week, maybe they're going to start learning to play a little bit of defense. But I think overall, because Iowa's offense is sort of ordinary at best up to this point in the season, everyone is going to be in the game. Colorado State isn't a great team. They were leading Iowa at the half because they were finding a way to protect the football, and Iowa's offense didn't do a whole lot against them. When it came down to it, Iowa made key plays when they had to, just like they did in so many other moments. But so much of what happened early in the season was an opponent's backed up. You're snapping the ball over the quarterback's head, or someone's going in to score and you fumble it away. Like some of that, in addition to just sheer excellence and force of will on defense, all factored into a magnificent start. Now you need to see if your Iowa continue to build off of that early success. Because as Kirk Ferentz has continued to remind you guys who talk to him on a regular basis, they're going to have to play much better than that, than where they were at key points in the season if they're truly going to be a championship team. But you look around the country, you see some squads starting to ascend, like Ohio State. Couple of games there going into their bye week started to look like the Buckeyes again. That's a bad deal for anyone who has to face Ohio State the rest of this year. Fortunately for Iowa, they're not one of those teams. They're only going to see the Buckeyes if it comes in the Big Ten championship game. But there are certain teams beginning to ascend. Iowa, you know, you got to hope that they haven't plateaued here. Off the bye week, they got to show they can ascend. And a lot of that has to happen on offense. So, yes, Purdue is a threat. Minnesota is a threat. Wisconsin, you know, they're going to turn it over on offense too. So anyone who turns it over, even with their defense, the Badgers and the Cornhuskers, they got to prove to me they can protect the football before I consider them a big time threat. Certainly not on the same level, but Minnesota and Purdue, they got defenses. Minnesota's got a run game. We already just saw what Purdue's able to do to Iowa. So I definitely think those three are all, you know, I suppose of a similar stature as West Division threat with Iowa leading the fray.
Yeah, I think when I look at those teams, then you start to examine schedule, and that really matters. And Purdue's got to play Ohio State and Michigan State, along with Indiana, which is a rivalry game. And Indiana, you know, that might end up making their season because they've had so many tough losses to pretty good teams. You know, look at Minnesota, they've got to beat their rivals. You know, they've got to beat Wisconsin and Iowa. And as we said, we haven't won in Iowa City since 99. And before that, it was 89. So they don't have a lot of success here. And then Wisconsin, their defense is legit, lights out legit like it always is. And probably more impressive simply because they haven't had any kind of offense. But if they could just, if I look at their passing game, if they could just have a net zero, no interceptions, you know, 50% completion percentage, no interceptions, then you got a 50-50 chance to win a lot of these games that normally you would or wouldn't. But, you know, so I guess that's why I skew towards Iowa. But I think Minnesota has its chance to come to Iowa City and win. But overall, who do you like? Who do you think is going to end up in Indy and playing in the championship game?
At the moment, my money would still be on Iowa and Ohio State. I think the bye week comes at a good time. You know, like a squad like Wisconsin, it had their bye after like two games. Man, that's unfortunate in the season that's this deep in the Big Ten Conference. You get your bye that early, it's tough to reassess when you don't have some time to exhale throughout the midst of a competitive calendar. So the bye comes at a good time for Iowa. They can lick a few wounds up front on the offensive line. They can assess where they're at schematically and then be prepared for what I think is going to be a tough stretch run. I was telling, you know, everyone at the Big Ten Network the last couple of weeks, were like, all right, so Iowa's good. Who's going to come out of the East? Like, nah, man, you gotta slow up a little bit. Iowa's not scoring the ball at a high enough clip to just assume anything in that West Division. And so now that feels more wide open. But I do, in the end, still think Iowa coming out of the bye is going to be strong. I think it's going to be Iowa out of the West. And Ohio State is looking like the Buckeyes, man. And in the end, C.J. Stroud is probably going to end up in New York as a Heisman Trophy finalist. He is uber talented, as is virtually everyone else on Ohio State's offense. And their defense finally showed up. So I think we're going to see the Buckeyes versus the Hawkeyes.
Yeah, I'm there with you on this one. I do think out of the East that Penn State's the second best team. I'm just – Michigan – I want to see more against quality opponents. Right, Michigan right. State has a really tough go because they also have a crossover with Purdue. And two things kind of scare me a little bit about the Spartans and trying to project them at a high level. One, in games against Nebraska and Indiana, they didn't run very well. And two, they rank 14th in pass defense. And they're facing, you know, again, you know, they'll have to face David Bell and Purdue. They're going to have to face Ohio State and, you know, Jahan Dotson. And so I think that, that's why I'm probably the Michigan schools I'm thinking are 3 and 4 in the East. And I like Iowa versus Ohio State and Indianapolis. And as we've seen in the past, one thing with Kirk Ferentz is every time you think that they're done, that this is over, you know, they come out smoking. And they did that to Ohio State in 2017. And probably the greatest turnaround I've ever seen in any sport or for any team was when they got just annihilated at Penn State in 2016. And their offense was even more challenged than it is now. Certainly was through the air. Gave up 600 yards, and then they beat number 2 Michigan at home 14-13. And so – they can find ways to get it done. I'm not predicting anything in Indianapolis or anything. I'm just saying right now everybody's going to say, oh, this is going to be a 3 touchdown win for the Buckeyes. And I'm like, slow it down a little bit here. Well, I've got a couple other questions for you because you've got such an interesting background and, you know, playing at Iowa. Now you're, you know, a full-fledged analyst on a lot of different networks. You know, Big Ten is part of your responsibility. The Bears are too. But first I want to ask you was, did anybody ever have bigger shoulder pads than you?
Probably not. Whenever someone on Twitter, myself or others post a photo, one of my action photos from back, especially back in my Iowa days, I wised up a little bit in the NFL, got slightly smaller shoulder pads, but Yeah, it's become quite the topic out in the Twitter sphere, looking at old action photos of me from Iowa. It was a different time back then. It was all about safety. And now it's a little bit different. It's about sleek, stylish, you know, try to get as small a pad as you can, whether shoulders, thighs, knees, you name it, hip pads. I had them all. But yeah, it's a different time these days.
Yeah, it sure is. It's funny when you look back at pictures from the 80s, 90s, and you know, the big shoulder pads. I was a quarterback in high school, so I had two different kinds. I had one for when I was a safety and one when I was a quarterback. Okay. And then you had the fullbacks with the neck rolls.
Yeah.
Monty, that's why I like watching Monty Potterbaum. He looks like, you know, if nothing else, he should be 1986 with a jean jacket.
Exactly.
You know, right. He's got the bullet going and everything. What was it like going from the ultimate players coach at Hayden Fry to Kirk Ferentz, who, you know, everybody knows is pretty stoic, that doesn't know him very well? What was that transition like for you as a player?
It wasn't easy at first because most of us at that time, Kirk had been removed from the program for a while once you got to the late 90s. And, you know, he was an offensive line coach for Hayden. So it wasn't like, you know, he was this kind of great renowned figure in Hawkeye football lore. And all of us assumed it was going to be Hawkeye legend and more renowned assistant and coordinator, Bob Stoops. We thought he was going to get the gig. And so this Kirk Ferentz guy walks in, we're like, who? You know, we just had to, you know, Google wasn't prominent back then, but we're all kind of going through blue.wig and, you know, trying to figure out how do we research this and figure out who this Kirk Ferentz guy is. And, you know, it's a different approach, different style, different personality, like you say, Coach Fry, you know, Hayden Fry. Now, you know, on game days, Coach Fry would get after you, he'd lay into you. But then the other 6 days of the week, he was kind of like a grandfatherly sort of figure and a very colorful personality, and jovial. And he'd literally end every practice. Either he'd make a joke or somebody bring somebody else in to make a joke. Who's got a cheer? Somebody would come in for some, you know, a little motivational moment. Yeah, that wasn't Kirk. But at the same time, both just great men, solid men, you know, dependable guys you can kind of count on. And I think that once we kind of got accustomed to Kirk and got used to, you know, what the program would be in his image, and certainly now in retrospect, seeing what it's become over the years since then, too, you understand the decision that Bob Bowlesby made and why he went that direction and the stability that it's provided to Hawkeye football and to, you know, U of I athletics.
Yeah, for sure. What was it like for you to be there when the Silverdome closed down? That was your game. You know, you got to play in the final game in Silverdome history. What was that like?
It was something else, man. It was cool because my rookie year in the NFL, I didn't know exactly what I was getting into. And I dreamt more about being in the NBA than I did in the NFL when I was a kid. So I didn't grow up revering some of the great football stadiums around the country. So the Silverdome, I was certainly aware of it because the Bears would go and play the Lions there, especially Thanksgiving games that would take place and everything. But I got there, the Silverdome was a dump. It's like, man, my facilities and I was like, Kinnick is better than this. What's going on, man? This is what life is like in the National Football League. So that was my rookie year. And the by the second year, we were at Ford Field in downtown. It was far more modernized as a facility than what the Silverdome was. But, you know, I didn't recognize how different it was. It's, you know, a little bit different now than it was 20 years ago. But initially, in my time in the NFL, you had some new facilities that had kind of popped up here and there. But there were a lot of dumps around the National Football League that, you know, whether it was because of taxpayer dollars or whatever, people just let stadiums get run down and run out and didn't really revamp them as frequently as it seems like is the case now. You got these palaces all over the place now, these cathedrals to sports and other activities that get used in a lot of different ways. But to play the last game at the Silverdome, no one was disappointed that the Silverdome was going to be no more. No one on that roster, maybe some of the older guys who had some special moments there, I guess. But, you know, if they'd had their vote, maybe they'd have said, all right, refurbish things in Pontiac here. But I think overall, Ford Field turned out to be a pretty nice facility there for the Lions there after we made the move.
You, your career, you left the stage at Iowa just before it started to turn. But what was there a memory that you look back on and you really cherish, on the field, or it could be in a different situation?
Remember a couple of locker room celebrations late in my senior year in 2000. And there was one point where we'd won a couple of games late in 2000. And, you know, we thought that things were maybe starting to turn a corner. And we thought we were going to end on like a three-game winning streak, and then we kind of gave up a lead. We had a two-score lead late against Minnesota in the final game of the regular season. We kind of hyped that up as the Floyd Bowl because we knew we weren't going to qualify mathematically for a bowl game. So we said, let's end this season on a high note. And the Gophers came back late and beat us in that game. But myself, A.J. Blazek, I think LeVar Woods, a couple of the older guys who were on our way out, just sort of took a moment with tears all over ourselves, everywhere in the locker room, just addressing things to the team. And one thing I said to the guys was, I was one of a few people in the room when Bob Bowlesby was asking us about who the next coach would be. And frankly, I didn't know anything about Kirk Ferentz when Bowlesby hired him, but this guy and what you guys are doing next year, what we've started to build this year, are going to do something special. You're going to win a lot of games and championships. And I'm just, you know, privileged to kind of have been a part of that. And I remember kind of saying that in the locker room, just with everybody crying and slobbering and snotting all over each other in that after that final game against Minnesota. That one always stands out to me.
Sure. And finally, I want to ask you about the transition from player to analyst. Was this something that was always part of your plan, or was this one that kind of just came along the more you were in sports and through your days, you know, and trying to make an NFL team and then in the Arena League and what have you?
It really just kind of materialized. I was, you know, between bouncing around the NFL and being pretty injury plagued throughout most of that time, and then going to the Arena League and, you know, basically gotten tired of bouncing around the NFL from city to city and surgery to surgery and thinking, you know what, this arena football thing, back then you could still make pretty good money playing arena football and you didn't necessarily have any offseason commitments to the team. It was like, all right, I can make how much money for half the year and all my room and board is paid for it too? Sounds pretty cool. It's a good deal. And we were living in Nashville, and I ended up being fairly injury plagued in arena football also. Everybody's on AstroTurf. You got these weird walls surrounding you. And frankly, just my joints were held together by like super glue and popsicle sticks. I just, you know, I wasn't a well-built guy, apparently, in my knees and my back. And I had both knees I had surgeries on over one arena football offseason. And as we lived in Nashville, arena football was a spring and summer sport. So during the fall and winter, while I was rehabbing, someone convinced me to go and do an audition with the local Comcast affiliate in Nashville. So I did that and started calling a few high school games. In my mind, I'm still planning on playing football for a while, but it was just something to do over the off season. I did that 1 year and it went well. And then the following year, where I was still rehabbing, even in the midst of the season, they started bringing me into the local Fox affiliate and just do like some Nashville Cats updates because they had a partnership with the station. Then that turned into, you know what, do some overall sports updates. You know what, come fill in, because they had like a morning news and entertainment show that, you know, a lot of different cities will have those where it was just like, you know, male host and a female host, just kind of banter about different things and have a good time. Let me come in and start filling in doing that. It's like, you know what? I got a few people around town here. Nashville's a good sized media market. Folks who know what they're talking about say you should really consider this as a career path. I said, yeah, maybe I will. And then that just led to more and more opportunities and kind of a deeper pursuit and really a deep enjoyment of it. And I just, you know, every opportunity that comes up, TV, radio, in front of the camera, sometimes even behind the camera in the production booth, editing things, just I've really enjoyed the creativity that the industry allows me because I'm, you know, some of the on-air personality or persona, I have to kind of dial it up a little bit. I'm naturally a fairly, you know, subdued personality, but, you know, this, I get a kick out of being able to show this side of myself that just kind of in standard conversation, I pretty frequently don't. And I feel like a teacher. That was the other gig I always wanted to do if I wasn't going to, before I thought of going into entertainment, I wanted to be a teacher. And I feel like I get to teach football and teach sports to people in this role.
Well, that's great. It's been fun watching you. I mean, I remember you at the Pac-12 and a lot of times, you know, I think a lot of these new networks have helped former players like yourself get opportunities. And some have been on for a year and they're off doing other things. And then other ones like you have really soared in the industry. And I would say you certainly haven't plateaued. You're well on your way to being a major face and voice in this sport or the NFL too. So, well, I really appreciate all the time, Anthony. And we, as always, want to thank you, our legends and listeners, for spending time with us and adding us to your podcasting rotation. So for Anthony Heron, this is Scott Docterman, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.